Can't you see it? The world powered by solar and renewable energy. Here at Graybar, with years of renewables experience, we live in that world. Get in touch to see for yourself.
We are now ready to depart.
Book your visit at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Get a head start on 2025 with CNBC's Big January, the hottest tech event, CES, from Las Vegas. The data, the numbers, the jobs report, and meet the future of biotech and pharma at JPM Healthcare. Check out the Amex Golf Tournament from California, Inauguration Day, and the meeting of world leaders in Davos. Plus, the first Fed decision of the year. Get ahead of the game. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
TJ Edwards. We were serious about the Bears growing up. Like, my dad, my mom, every Sunday. I don't know how many times I've had to listen to actually this show in the car.
Linebacker for your Chicago Bears.
Edwards fills the gap. That is the 14th tackle today.
Yeah, I had the Hester jersey. I got a picture somewhere with Urlacher. His rookie year, he had like a meet and greet or whatever, so I got to meet him. I was a big Briggs fan, you know, Mike Brown, like all those dudes. Me and my buddies would just kind of emulate them growing up in the backyard, messing around. So it's surreal that it's all kind of come full circle like this, for sure.
Former Lakes Community High School quarterback.
Edwards back to pass. Down the middle, he's got Spencer, and he makes the catch at the 40.
TJ Edwards with Bernstein and Harris on the score.
What a time to talk to TJ Edwards, who joins us on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa Sports app today. The Bears linebacker is on Twitter at TJ Edwards 8, the numeral. And he's on Twitch TV, twitch.tv/Chicago670 The Score. Anthony Herron in for Marshall Harris here on Bernstein and Harris. TJ, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you guys doing?
Good. Did you have a lovely Christmas with your family?
Yeah, really, really didn't do much. My parents are in Florida, so we had a little FaceTime and stuff like that, and kind of just hung out, man. Took the dog for a walk, and that was about it.
That's actually, I must admit, a little bit surprising, even with the folks being down in Florida. You're able to just lay low on Christmas.
Yeah.
I guess you had some activities coming up the following day where you're probably trying to rest up a little bit. But I would imagine there's some expectations between the holiday and playing in your hometown and everything else. Folks just left you alone, huh?
You know, it's one of those where I wasn't, you know, too upset about it. Obviously, with the game being the next day, it's a little different scenario. You know, we had to go down to the hotel that night and everything like that. But it's a blessing, man. Got to see them, you know, via phone and all that. And hope you guys had a good Christmas as well.
It'll never be as sad as a Christmas my rookie year. I was in Detroit. And we didn't play on Christmas, but it was one of those where we had a game.
Yep.
Christmas adjacent. I went to the Greektown Casino and was just hanging out on Christmas Day by myself in the Greektown Casino in Detroit. Just, I couldn't think anything else better to do my rookie year. So my Christmas was a lot more sad than yours sounds.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll take the dog over that, I think, but it's all good.
I stayed in the Detroit Greektown Casino. I actually had a lovely time there. So
yeah, it's not bad. It's not where I planned to be on Christmas.
You could certainly do worse. The Bears' performance on Thursday night was, to be kind, lackluster. And you all heard it. You all heard, TJ, how dissatisfied the fans were. And I'm sure you were dissatisfied, too. It's just the latest necessitation of your ability to compartmentalize, I guess. And you've been remarkable at it all year, sort of understanding how the fans feel, also knowing you got to keep going out there and doing your job.
Yeah. I mean, it's... You know, you feel, obviously we feel the same, right? We feel the same kind of frustrations and disappointment. And obviously Chicago is a very passionate place, right? It's a team that, it's a city that cares about its teams a lot, especially football. And they want to see good things happening. And, you know, of late, you know, the last, you know, stretch of years, it hasn't. So when you get a passionate city like that and you know, they're expecting good things, they're not happening, you're gonna hear it. That's kind of how it goes. But you know, I think that's a part of me, right? I want to be here for when that ship turns, right? When it's when we can do those things to flip the script because really, when you know, when you're winning, there's really no better place to win than here, for sure.
What was better about the brand of defense that you guys played? Seattle went into that game. Yeah, it's a short week for everybody, but all that talent they have on offense, quarterback who've been putting up millions of yards, it felt like, and a game they needed to stay alive in the playoff picture. You held them to 6 points. What was better about the execution in that game than it had been in recent weeks?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we got off to a great start. I think with that first drive, they're able to kind of do some things, some unscouted looks, and, you know, kind of that first 15, right, that you see every week. So you kind of have to be prepared to kind of just play rules at that point. But I felt like from there we got settled. We were able to, I don't know, kind of just lock into what we were doing, right? They were giving us certain things and made really good adjustments on the sidelines and at halftime, and we were able to kind of correct the things that we were doing. And I just thought guys were making plays. I think Kyler's fumble was huge. I think the D-line, their pressure on the quarterback was big all night. You know, DT with a sack there too, and getting the ball out. Just anytime you can kind of make plays in those type of games where you need momentum, that's all you can do, you know, is try to give the other team, try to give our offense, you know, extra possessions and things like that. And, you know, unfortunately it didn't work out that way, but I was part of the battle, man. You know, obviously it was a tough environment where, you know, as expected, where things aren't going well. And we just kept battling till the very end.
When you say unscouted looks, how common is that? How often do you guys have to sort of look at each other like, "Ooh, boy, this wasn't on one of the cards during scout team. We have to figure this out." Is that common in the NFL? And going back to your experience with Philadelphia, is that how you guys consider how well you're being prepared?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, there's only a certain amount of things that you can see from your coaches during the week, right? You're never going to be able to see everything that's going to happen. You're never going to be able to, you know, rep every play that you're going to see. It's just, it's impossible. It's not how it works. And I feel like, you know, with our calls, it comes down to us understanding our rules so well that if we get a play that maybe we haven't seen, you know, we're able to still, you know, run that play correctly, you know, based on our rules. And they're running just a little type gap scheme that was a little different for us, and we were able to you know, we saw it once, and then after that we did well with it, but it gave us some issues to start. But I think it's a common thing, you know, every offensive coordinator is going to go in with their, you know, favorite plays of, you know, versus what they think we're going to play, and you know, from there they kind of get into what's worked and what hasn't, and then they kind of just, you know, repeat those plays. So it's a little bit of a chess game, I think, to start. But, you know, once you kind of get rolling and in the rhythm of the game, it's just football.
I'm happy to get an opportunity to talk to you, because there's a, I guess, a supposition that I've been kind of posing on the station here in recent weeks, where, you know, the best defenses that I was ever a part of, great defenses throughout the sport, tend to have a couple of jerks on them, you know, like guys who play with just a certain temperament that's going to get under the opponent's skin, maybe even get under their own teammate's skin, but kind of walk that line of, is it in the rules? Is it out of bounds? That sort of thing. I don't know if you want 11 of them on the field, but there can be quality defense that benefits from having a couple of them. You're obviously a very physical player, and you play with your hair on fire week in and week out, and it's why you've been so productive. Do you feel like that particular temperament, kind of the appropriate level of disdain for the opponent, is that something that can enhance the way that a defense performs?
I mean, absolutely. I think, I mean, like you said, right, I don't know if you want 11 dudes who are just, you know, but like you said, it's good to have a couple. And I think we do have guys who kind of just love to compete, right? Honestly, I think Jalen Johnson is like that. I think he's the guy who, no matter what, he just wants to beat the dude in front of him. No matter what it looks like, he wants to, you know, embarrass him, because honestly, Jalen's that good, right, where he can do those things. And but I think as a defense, we have kind of that chippiness, you know what I'm saying, and where we're frustrated, we're not going to go out there and just, you know, lay down and let the other team, you know, do whatever they want. I think it comes down to, and to me, I guess, you know, that's football for me, right? I believe that it's imposing your will on another human being, and being able to beat them snap after snap. And you know, obviously that's not how that goes in the NFL, because everyone's good. But I think having kind of that mindset of, you're not going to be able to you know, take what's mine. I think that's big time in this league, and I think that's why guys stick around and understand that every week you're going to be tested on that. So I think we have that type defense. I think, you know, again, it'll be a great test for us this week, too, going into Lambeau and everything like that against a team that's beaten us a consecutive amount of times now, and, you know, something to prove for sure.
I remember covering some teams. It was back when, you know, we'd be allowed on the field at the end of games and stuff, and, you know, just being around some Bears teams where every once in a while there would be a player who was legitimately scary, like an actual scary guy. And
yeah,
you know, when you talk to Anthony's point about sometimes you're like, dude, like this dude's like legit crazy, you know, and sometimes it's your teammate. And sometimes not. And sometimes you're the guys who have to get kicked out of a practice every once in a while. And it doesn't mean they're like that off the field. It just means when they get to that certain arousal level, you're like, holy crap, he's in a place. Have you ever had a teammate like that at any level where you just were kind of like, oh, okay, this guy's different?
I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think one, honestly, for a football team, that's healthy to have someone like that. To have someone kind of spark, you know, maybe it's a lull in camp or whatever, and you know that guy's going to kind of just either spark some competition, maybe a fight, but just to get things going. I'm trying to think. I mean, I feel like there's a number of guys who can get to that level, you know what I'm saying, who if pushed in a certain way can definitely get to that level.
I mean, people used to say it about John Randall, who was like a, you know, Hall of Fame level Pro Bowl player, but would get into such a frenzy and such a lather, and would go through the media guides and the bios and learn the names of his opponents' kids and pets and wives and talk about who he was going to kill and dismember. And I'm like, my God, man.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I've ever been around anyone like that before, or had that on my team, you know, because, yeah, no, I haven't seen anything to that extent, but I definitely know there's some, you know, to play this game, you kind of got to be wired differently anyway, to be able to go, you know, try to run through somebody every single play is a different mentality, but I've never... you know, to that extent, I've never, you know, you hear the stories of, you know, when I was in Philly, like Brian Dawkins and all that. And I've never got to see that personally, but I definitely know that it's out there for sure.
What were the stories? What was the best story?
I mean, I think, honestly, you just kind of, when I was in Philly, you kind of heard the legacy, right? And just then you see the clips of kind of just the person that he turned into. You know what I'm saying? When he was about to run on the field and like kind of turn into Weapon X and all that. And like, I guess I didn't know, I knew of him and all that, but until I got there, I didn't know like Weapon X had like his own locker, like in the locker room and all that. Like, I didn't know it was that serious. But it was what makes those guys so great, to be honest with you.
When you're reading the run game for an opponent, and it strikes me that one of the things that's made you so exceptionally productive is the way you can anticipate certain moments in the game. And it almost feels intuitive, even though there's obviously a lot of homework you're doing during the week to prepare for certain moments. But if you can, talk us through those times when you're going to do a run through, you know, when you feel like you've diagnosed a run, the back has declared, because especially with a lot of these zone schemes that teams will use, it isn't always defined where that back is going to declare. And when you guess, you got to guess right when you're going to go get it. So what's that like for you? And what's the process that you're going through both mentally and physically to go make a play on the other side of the line of scrimmage?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it is, you know, film study in that sense, in terms of just understanding teams' kind of favorite runs, and especially runs that they like against certain fronts. And, you know, and I think it's also understanding how the guys in front of me play, right? I know if we get a, you know, a outside zone type run to the three tech side, I know that there's going to be some type of wash to where I can kind of fold in and kind of replace that gap a little quicker than I would on a, you know, on a, just an inside zone play. And a lot of it is also just kind of getting a feel for the game as it's going. I mean, Seattle was hitting us with a certain play where they're running type of bubble and then with a little kind of either gap scheme away from it or something like that throughout the game. They hit us three or four times with it, and then that was that third and four that I kind of heard something similar that I heard on a check, you know, throughout the game, and was able to kind of just anticipate. And as soon as I saw the back kind of go flat, I knew what play it was, and I was able to just kind of shoot the gap and go make a play. But I think a lot of those things come with, you know, now that I have played a good amount of ball, I kind of understand how things fit but also understanding kind of how the opponent's trying to attack you too.
All right, let's talk about this upcoming game. And you have spoken at length about your unique perspective, considering your time in Madison and marrying into a Packer family. So what does this week mean as a Chicago Bear, especially it being the last game of the season, perhaps the last chance for you guys to go out feeling good about yourselves with a win?
Yeah, I think that's all that's on our mind is we just, you know, I feel like there's been so much that we've gone through this year, but to go out here and go put a complete game together, go put a great performance together in front of a hostile environment, you know, and again, a team that's beaten us consecutive amount of times, that you know, that hurts, man. And you know, me being from here, that nothing pisses me off more. And so kind of just understanding that too. And, you know, best believe the family group chat's been rolling a little bit this week too. So it's been all good, but we're definitely excited just to, again, one last performance with this team, understanding kind of perspective wise too, that it's the NFL, right? And things change so quickly. So understanding that this group won't look the same next year. So going out there, you know, to Lambeau, noon, going to be cold, go out there and put a complete game together, right, for the last time this year, I think is nothing better than kind of, you know, where we're at in the season too.
Helmet communication gets discussed largely just through the quarterback position with the offensive play caller. So once Matt Eberflutes gets fired, you've got a different voice in your ear on defense. And now it's been several weeks of Eric Washington as that defensive signal caller for you guys. Is there a rhythm for defensive players, for green dot guys on defense with a different voice, a different signal caller in your ear that you feel like maybe you guys are starting to find something?
I mean, so I've had this in the past on my past team where, you know, you change in signal callers. And I think it takes a little bit, but I also think that you know, the defense is the defense, right? So being able to kind of anticipate how things are being called, I think is huge. And I think Tremaine has done such a good job with that these past 2 years that I've been with him. And I know that, you know, me, him, and Coach Washington have a good understanding, and kind of, you know, even after every series, we're coming off the field and we're talking about what could possibly be up next and kind of what Coach Washington's thinking, what we're seeing on the field in terms of how they're attacking us and how we can maybe switch up things to kind of get different looks. But I feel like Tremaine has done such a good job of kind of commanding that, in a sense of whether we're getting the call earlier, you know, whether we need to maybe talk about our, you know, situation that's coming that we're, you know, going into on the field. And I feel like we've all been on the same page, which is, that gives you the best shot, right? I think that's one of the easiest ways to lose is to be yourself. And that's not being ready. That's not understanding what you're doing. And, you know, I don't think we've had that. It's just kind of, we got to go out there and execute a little bit better at times. But I think the communication's been really good.
Bears fans always like it when they feel that the Bears actually understand and embody the local rivalry. And in the past, not every year, but in the past, I know sometimes whether it's ownership or some level of the Bears management has brought in some old timers, some to say, hey, this is still meaningful, this means something. Do they do that? Is it still reinforced, or are we just so far past that now?
I know what you're saying. I don't know if there's any, you know, not that since I've been here, been guys like come in and talk about the rivalry and things like that, but I feel like we understand it here. You know, I think I remember the beginning of the year, the first time we played the Packers, we kind of had a little defensive film, just like watching some of the highlights of the game to kind of get people to understand, you know, what this means. And, you know, and again, I think my mindset's a little different too, just because I've lived it, I've been through it, you know, I've seen it firsthand, and understand how important this game is. And I think it's just a pride thing too, right? Like, it's a division rival. It's a team that has beaten you again for a while now, and it's kind of just understanding that, you know, there's people that aren't expecting a lot from us, and what are you going to do about it? I think that's what's exciting to me is, you know, being counted out and being able to go out there on their home field and go out there, compete to get a win.
Matt LaFleur is hailed as one of the best play callers in the sport. Certainly got quality personnel over there. From a defensive perspective, what are going to be a couple of the keys to you guys going out and performing well at Lambeau?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're a very explosive offense, and I think they do such a good job of their play action game, their screen game, you know, kind of getting guys out in space, just to kind of isolate matchups and things like that. But no, it's a with a great run game now too. I think Josh Jacobs has done really good things for them. He's quick, powerful, with a O-line who's played together with some time now. It's a really good offense, man, and they understand kind of where they're at on the field, how to attack certain defenses. So you can tell that they're operationally very sound. It's going to come down to who makes more plays. That's plain and simple. There's going to be one-on-ones that guys have to win. There's going to be pass rush that guys have to win to kind of make Jordan Love as uncomfortable as he can, because I feel like when he's poised back there and able to see everything, they're hard to beat. So we got to try to speed him up a little bit and kind of hurry that count up, just so that we can kind of react and go anticipate and go make plays, man. And at the end of the day, bring our own juice. I think, especially going into this stadium, I think getting momentum early will be big time for us.
Do you guys get to sleep in tomorrow, or is it business as usual?
Business as usual, man. That's how it goes. I was just talking about that with a couple of guys. It's like New Year's and all that, but I mean, it's also a Tuesday. That's what's tough. It's just a tough day, to be honest with you. Nothing we can do.
Hey, if we're being honest, though, if we're being honest, seriously, so we're having people over, which means I have to stay up until midnight just because we're hosting people. And I'm just like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? It just seems so, for old, we olds, I'd like to be in bed by 10. And now I can't. So I'm actually envious of you.
Get your afternoon coffee going, man. You'll be all right.
Yeah, I guess, whatever. All right, TJ, thanks as always. Happy, healthy new year. And here's to closing out the season on a positive note.
Absolutely. Happy new year to you guys, man. Talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, TJ.
That's TJ Edwards, who has been a delight all year.
You just call TJ Edwards old?
No, I said we olds, as in people my age.
Okay, not the collective we.
You. No, okay. we and my okay. and my fellow okay. olds.
Your fellow olds. Gotcha.
Yes, all but right. I'm not allowed to be tonight. I got to pretend to be a young tonight. So that means either coffee or nap. But you know what's going to happen? Have you seen the movie Slapshot?
Oh, yeah.
You know when he tries to nap?
No.
Remember when Reg Dunlop, it's the big game. It's the day of the big game. Okay. And he's in his Spartan little apartment, and he's lying down, and he's in his boxers and his T-shirt, and he puts the sock over his eyes. And every time he's about to fall asleep, another issue comes up or another something happens, and the dog comes over or the phone rings, and somebody's got to. So all he wants to do in the world is just nap.
A bad napper in
general.
Awful at naps.
I'm the worst.
Oh, man.
Some people are so good at it.
I'm so envious. If sleeping on airplanes, like moving vehicles, I can fall asleep in a moving vehicle no matter how tight and cramped and uncomfortable I am. If it's an airplane or a bus, you name it, I can fall asleep.
I can't.
But when it's just nap time, if I'm motionless and you just tell me to lay down and nap, cannot do it.
Well, some guys, Drew McGarry always brags about his napping ability, the writer. He says that the key is having a hoodie that you can just kind of pull down over your eyes. And I can occasionally do it like a golf nap on a slow, like a non-football weekend where you just hear like the ASMR of the gnat sound of the golf and kind of drift off.
I feel like Lawrence talks about quality naps. Am I remembering that correctly?
He's good at it, though. Yeah, I think he's actually good at it. I've always struggled, and then I get in my head. I'm supposed to be napping, but I'm still up. I should be asleep by
asleep
now.
Yet?
Now I only
Close
have
your eyes.
Now I only
Shut
have an hour.
Tighter.
Right now, I only have an hour and 20 minutes left to nap. Damn it! Right. Now I only have 68 minutes left to nap. Well, now screw it. I'll go work out instead.
Who wants to nap for 53 minutes? Just get up and do
right.
something.
There's no point.
Go live your life.
God. Now I'm all screwed. So now I know I definitely can't. I guess I'll have to do the coffee. Oh, whatever. It shouldn't be this difficult, should it?
Have your wife put you in a sleeper hole.
She'd love to. when we return, the Cubs' pursuit of star Japanese pitcher Roki Sasaki is very interesting, as is, I think, a minor trade that they made that I think might matter. So I want to touch on a little baseball when we come back on The Score.
The Bernstein and Harris Show.
There will be, on the non-relaxed brain show, no self-congratulations.
I mean, it's still early in the offseason, and certainly there's a lot of players out there, and our team's not complete, so we'll continue to make a lot of moves. So I think that we're not done. We have to continue to round out the team to get better for next year, and we'll work on that for the next couple months.
Well, let's see what kind of big splash moves are left for the Cubs after they make the move to trade for Kyle Tucker. They still haven't extended him yet, so we will see if that's a one-year rental or not. There was a minor deal that they made that I kind of liked, that in an exchange of disappointments, they went to the Marlins and they swapped out Matt Mervis for Vidal Bruján.
That has to take place during the holidays, right? The exchange of disappointments?
it's like an O. Henry story. The gift of the Magi, the exchange of disappointments, it's official. But Vidal Bruján has some value. And you may remember that for a long time, he was, I think, a top 100 prospect out of the Dominican Republic. He's 5'10", 180. He plays every position. And he's still only 27, but other than catcher and pitcher, he plays every position at a pretty good level, and that's valuable. If this means that you've got a better version of Miles Mastroboni, a better version of Madrigal, if this guy can be more speedy, athletic, and if they could figure out the bat, because that really that's just what hasn't been there is the batting out of the bat. The glove is there. The athleticism is there, everything that scouts have seen, but I like it. I don't mind if you think that this guy is a fair shot to be your super sub every man, give Nico Horner a break every now and then, give Dansby Swanson, anybody. He can play anywhere.
Now, being willing to see this through a positive lens, is that with the idea that another truly big move is on the way as well, or are you just able to view it through the context of here's this move in its own prism, and this is a serviceable player that's a better, like, enhanced version of your movable chess piece within the infield and outfield, or does the other big move need to happen?
Not necessarily, just in and of itself, I just think there's upside. I don't think Mervis is going to be very good, and if he is, more power to him. And literally more power to him. But if he can end up being what they saw, great. This could be a win-win trade for both teams. There's really no risk to it. And I'm just an upside fan of that kind of athleticism and versatility as a 25th, 26th guy on the bench. Now, the big fish, the only other move would be if Roky Sasaki buys the Cubs pitch. Because this guy, oh boy. Is he a talent? And this isn't like Shota. This isn't a guy who's 30 years old who is coming over after already spending most of his professional career elsewhere. Roky Sasaki is 23, and he is one of the best pitchers in the world. Mm. He throws 100. He has a split finger. I don't know if you watch the videos, if you go to Pitching Ninja or
check him out.
Codify and the other stuff. I've been watching Roky Sasaki Pitching Ninja videos for 2 years now.
No.
And like real-time stuff where they give you the batter's approximation of what it looks like, all sorts of the overlays between where he releases the 100-mile-an-hour fastball, where he releases the splitter. I don't know what you do. I don't know how you hit him. And he's going to write his own ticket. We'll see if it's the Cubs.
So if he's put his short list together, reportedly, I mean, when we talk about the Bears, we kind of know how the Bears would likely package what makes them appealing to the next coach or to a free agent. We got money to spend. We got a young, talented quarterback. We got a passionate fan base. What's a part of the Cubs' pitch? They've had success with international born talent, with Japanese players, pretty frequently here, especially of recent vintage. So what would the key elements of the Cubs' pitch to Roky Sasaki be?
I think it is literally the pitching. I think it's their pitching infrastructure. I think it is pitch lab. I think it is their understanding of pitch engineering. A lot of stuff that's made baseball unwatchable.
They're kind of nouveau riche, and that actually being viewed as a strength for them, though, right? Because they went years without actually developing arms.
But they've done it. They've been able to trade away some of their developed assets or developed enough assets. And this is what the agent for Roky Sasaki, Joel Wolf, had to say. And he said that market size, living dynamics, and even tradition of winning won't be the foremost priority.
Gambling advice will. No, yeah. He didn't say that.
According to ESPN, he said he doesn't seem to look at it in the typical way that other players do. He has a more long-term global view of things. I believe Roki is also very interested in pitching development and how a team is going to help him get better, both in the near future and over the course of his career. He didn't seem overly concerned about whether a team had Japanese players on their team or not, which in the past, when I represented Japanese players, that was sometimes an issue. That was never a topic of discussion. He also apparently gave every team with which he met a homework assignment to say, look, here's something I want to know. Here's a problem to solve, and say, how would you deal with this? And we know the Cubs were among those that was granted an initial meeting. None of it's been confirmed. People are saying with all this and all this smoke, it's still going to come down to Dodgers and Padres just because of how many the Japanese players like the proximity to, you know, cut another 4 or 5 hours off the flight if they want to head home. But this is I until the Cubs aren't in it, I'm going to presume they are. I don't think Shota is going to have any bad things to say after the year that he had. And even if it is not necessarily important to him in his official criteria, I think having a countryman speak to him in a way, understanding certainly, you know, colloquially and idiomatically what his experience was like, would be a positive.
Would Yu Darvish be a comp? They seem to be of similar stature. If he's got immense velocity and some of the kind of nuanced finesse aspects of various arm slots and those types of things that we kind of think of with Japanese-born pitchers, is Yu Darvish a decent comp?
I think Darvish is a unicorn just because he's got 16 different pitches.
Okay.
And Sasaki's a little more traditional in his setup. It's, you know, mostly fastball splitter, where the embarrassment of riches that Darvish has to throw at you, that he can work, he can say, look, I'm choosing pitches 1, 6, 9, and 14 today, or this time through the order. And he doesn't always have command of all of them, and sometimes it makes it difficult for catchers, too, just to be like, dude, you know, concentrate on something.
Yeah.
You know, but I have not heard a Darvish comp on him, just because kind of it gets facile just because they both happen to be from Japan.
Yeah, right.
But this guy's power, power, power. So we'll see. It would be a hell of a get for the Cubs, and then I would wait to see. I think the posting fee is already up, and I don't know exactly what the number. I don't think he gets the big deal yet. I think it's just international bonus pool, because he's not a true free agent yet, and that's why so many teams are coming after him, because more teams can afford him right now.
So at 23 years old, if you know his agent is saying that he's not that concerned with having, you know, other Japanese or Japanese-born players on the roster already, would that be viewed as a newer thing? Is that kind of this next generation of Japanese-born talent is going to be less concerned with the transition to playing football or playing baseball in the U.S., whereas historically?
I don't know. It's a smaller world, right?
Yeah.
It just is in general.
Yeah.
I mean, distances don't seem as great. I think the overall connectedness of everything. I definitely think American fans are kind of well past the idea of, ooh, the exotic, inscrutable player coming over, the mystery man. And they're just enjoying these guys on their own terms, especially what Ichiro and Nomo and so many of those, particularly Ichiro, once people realized that he is just a, you know, funny, normal teammate.
Right.
Everybody loved the guy, as well as being a super dedicated player. And then you have, now we know that the greatest player on the planet, and maybe the greatest player ever, happens to be a Japanese player.
And that would stand to reason, right? If the younger, this next generation, after watching for decades now, Japanese-born players come to the U.S. and be able to have success, and a number of them even dominate the sport here and find comfort, you know, in playing baseball in the United States. Doesn't mean it won't be difficult, but that if this generation is going to find it less daunting and say, you know what, all right, I don't necessarily have to have, you know, Japanese-born talent that's already on that roster. I'm going to be willing to join up with them. I think it would stand to reason just for that to be the evolution of this as more and more Japanese-born talent comes here to play baseball.
And more of it can be decided by money. You can, yeah. you can buy your own comfort level at some point.
But that wouldn't be the new part, though, right? I mean, the money's been there for a while.
Yeah, it comes down to the individual. It always does. It comes down to that individual comfort level that you can't quantify. And that sometimes you don't know. It's like sending a kid off to college. There's a leap of faith, right? And sometimes you get it right on the first try. And knowing from experience, sometimes you get it wrong on the first try. And you figure it out. And he might be in a situation where he and his agent. And look, like you say, Joel Wolf has represented a lot of Japanese players. Mm. So he knows what to ask. He knows what issues his other clients have had. So I don't think it's going to be for a lack of being informed. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going into some wide-eyed kid jumping into this like, oh boy, I'm just so happy to be playing here. It sounds like he's asking the right questions, and I hope the Cubs can answer him correctly.
That'd be nice. They could use him. They use an arm, man. They use a powerful arm.
Watch. Go click around on just some Roki Sasaki stuff. And it is, he's got just remarkable ability and an easy, it's a low effort delivery too. It doesn't look like he's a maxed out effort guy. So that's always something you look at to see. Yeah. But it's, and I say that, I sound like an old baseball scout, but it's not predictive of future injury. But it's still something you like to see because it shows that the guy can operate under control. There's usually less that can go wrong with somebody who just looks like he's playing catch and it's going 102. when we return, you want to run through a wall?
Only if motivated in the proper way.
Well, I'll see if this rises to that level when we come back on The Score.
Dan Bernstein, Marshall Harris. The Bernstein and Harris Show, middays 10 till 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We're going to get up, and on the way up, we're going to bite a kneecap off.
No one's laughing at Dan Campbell now, damn it. Say what you want about the guy, but he is, what did Ruthie say about him, just about his authenticity? You know, earlier today during transition, you were busy. Yeah, she just talked about how genuine he is, how authentic he is, and I can't speak to the way a player would really feel about him. You know, I can speak the way I feel about, you know, my bosses and leaders for whom that I've worked, and it's always different. You are a former player.
Mm-hmm.
You're a former Detroit Lion, in fact.
Right.
This is the speech that Dan Campbell gave to his team after the game last night, remembering that the game didn't mean anything. The outcome didn't mean anything, and he played his guys and they won, and here's what he said.
I got an unbelievable amount of respect for you guys. I know what this was, and there's all these arguments about what did this game really mean, because the next week I respect the f*** out of you guys. I respect the f*** out of how we roll a ball out and you guys just go out and compete. I can't even put it into words, man. I cannot put it into words. I love the hell out of you guys. I love the hell out of you guys. Listen, we did some things. We got 14 wins. All right, we already talked about once we got to where we were at, 13, that we franchise record. 14's a franchise record. 8-0 on the road. Franchise record. All right, 8-0 on the road. Which tells you, at its worst, we can go anywhere and win, gentlemen. That's the bottom line. Listen, you can't ask for anything better. To be able to have the division and the one seat on the line back at home. Guys, this is what it's all about. This is why you're in this profession, man. This is as good as it gets. We're so thankful for this opportunity. This can be unbelievable. Appreciate you guys, man. It's a hell of a job. It's a hell of a ride, and we got one more. Break it down.
Where does that stand in your scale?
I like it. I mean, it's one of those chicken or egg types of conversations, because the Vikings' successful locker room and hoisting Sam Darnold up on their shoulders, the Lions' successful locker rooms where, you know, Dan Campbell just sounds hoarse and is using, you know, colloquialisms and is just talking about love and things that, you know, would likely be scoffed at if it wasn't such a successful season. But when you're in the midst of that and you can see, and like the term Ruthie used there, that it comes off so authentic, his passion, his love for his guys, and for what last night's game was. I spoke to you guys about it a bit yesterday. It struck me as such an awkward game because there's a variety of ways that that game could have been approached. If, Hall of Famer Tony Dungy had that game awaiting his team, he'd have sat everybody.
And it would not necessarily have been wrong.
You can make a logical case for why that makes perfect sense, because if Jahmyr Gibbs gets hurt in that game last night where he runs for over 100 yards, or if Jared Goff gets his ankle turned by Nick Bosa bursting into the backfield, beating somebody on a block, and now your end goal is jeopardized because of that. Next week is jeopardized because of that. But that's just not how Man Campbell rolls. When there's a game to be played, when this roster is available to him to go out and play some football, he's going to put his best on the line to play football. And fortunately, they came out of that game without what appear to be any significant injuries, and they're ready to close out the NFL regular season with the division title on the line in the best division in football, and that's who that squad is. I respect the hell out of it.
So I found something interesting to pair with this, and it's a comment that Cole Kmet made. And the reason why I find it interesting is when you read it, and if it were coming from a commentator or an analyst or a talk show host, it would hit differently than it does coming from a current player, a current captain of a team in the division, talking about the success that other teams have had in this division.
Obviously, three really good coaches, and like I said, three different styles, but all styles that that have great buy-in from from those players, and they're executing at a high level. So, obviously, I'm sure here they're hard at work trying to find the next head coach here, and it's obviously it's a tough challenge coming in here with the division that we got, but also a great opportunity, and looking forward to see where it heads in terms of that direction.
So here's what I underlined. There are three different styles, three styles that have great buy-in from those players. That's a current player saying that.
Yeah.
I found that meaningful.
Yeah, very much so. And I was in a Lions locker room that was not bought into what Marty Morningweg was doing. And there was a bunch of veterans who weren't digging it. There were young guys like myself who were confused at the direction things were going. And I know what that feels like. I also know what it's like in the early portion of Jim Mora's time in Atlanta, where he eventually make an NFC championship game, and how exciting that was, and the energy he brought to things, and all the buy-in that was there in those initial seasons that he was running things with the Falcons. And it can feel drastically, dramatically different. And it doesn't guarantee you sustainability, because there's so much that has to go right to have sustainability at the level the Chiefs are in the midst of right now, or we've never seen anything like
that.
The Patriots special
were. Stuff. Like aspiring to that is great, but that is the kind of thing that even if you recognize it as it's going on, you know how remarkable it is.
But to get a moment in time, like right now for the Vikings, maybe this is just a moment in time. And for them to do everything they can to seize it and capitalize on it, they got to be bought in at least for this year. And then 2025 is going to be its own little microcosm, its own little vacuum, its own season that is going to be very unique and different from other seasons. But for this year, that buy-in matters. And it was so obviously not there for the Bears. And the players recognized it. And then at the time they were trying to do anything about it, it was obviously painfully too late to try and course correct at that point.
And it also tells you that they'll know relatively early, they know who they're going to follow out onto that field.
There will still have to be tangible results, though, because that enhances the buy-in.
Yes.
Things were awful for like a year and a half in Detroit when Dan Campbell was first there. And then the tangible evidence of results enhanced. They supported what he was putting out there. They supported his approach to things because the team developed and they began to win. And so all the other stuff that maybe was worthy of question, and you're wondering how much of this matters, and schematically, is he going for too many fourth downs because they were going awry at first, and the defense was giving up chunk plays?
Yeah, he looked reckless and stupid until he didn't.
Until he didn't, exactly. So you have to find that marriage. The buy-in and the belief matters. There was buy-in and belief closing out 2023 with Matt Eberflus, and then it got to a point pretty early this year where there was just no there.
Do you think there was, though? I doubt that. There might have been from above Eberflus. Because I don't know.
Why would you doubt that when you look at the results at the end of the season last year? They were playing good football. So, that was there.
But I think the point you made is that it's chicken and the egg. That, sure, they might have been playing good football, but we don't know what starts what. And maybe they started playing good football, and they got excited for the next year. All right, now here we go.
Yeah.
But then their effort wasn't necessarily reciprocated from coaching doing right by them. Certainly in the hiring that the coaches made, however you want to define coaching. So I always would be curious about the extent. Were there always doubts? I was like, yeah, our coach is kind of an idiot, but we'll be fine.
I think they were all growing along a path together. You know, and there were other headlines and shiny objects like what's going to happen with Justin, what's going to happen with the top pick. And
right.
There were other things to kind of track within the locker room and externally. And as they're all growing together, they're winning. And, yeah, those matters. Like, you know, I know you played back some of the Eberflus post games where they were joyous after a win. And like, you know what? All right, this doesn't sound too bad. No, I think the players, there might have always been a question mark at the end of it to a certain extent. But they were in the process of building something. You recognize that when it's happening. The Bears' defense was certainly bought in. And then there was just too many boneheaded late-game decisions and the mismanagement of so many things. So, yeah, you can definitely be out after you were previously in. They were definitely out, you know, after a little time in this season here. But I think last year they were bought in, and then things went awry.
Tim Jenkins will break down the latest Caleb Williams performance, and will take his temperature on how he's doing being a Bears fan, or against his will. It's really quite a science experiment that's going on here, so we'll check in with it next.